Pistol is a 6-episode limited series about the rock and roll revolution based on guitarist Steve Jones's memoir, Lonely Boy, Tales from a Sex Pistol. This is the story of a band of spotty, noisy, working class kids with, quote, no future, who shook the boring establishment to its core, threatened to bring down the government and changed music and culture forever. In typical Sex Pistol styles, not all members approve of the series, with John Lydon even bringing Steve Jones and Paul Cook to court to try to prevent the use of their music. He lost. Pistol stars Toby Wallace, Anson Boone, Maisie Williams, and is directed by Danny Boyle. Pat Carty has been watching Pistol for us, and he's with me in studio this evening. Just remind us, first of all, Pat, if you would, of the picture that was circulated when the cast was announced for Pistol. Met with derision, it has to be said, wasn't it?
You could certainly say that, and I wasn't backward in coming forward, giving out about it either. It came out about a year ago, and it had Toby Wallace, who plays Steve Jones, Anson Boone, who plays Johnny Rotten or John Lydon, and Sid Vicious, or the Sid Vicious version, in this. And to be honest with you, they looked, for the first glance at it, they looked very drama school. Mm-hmm. And it kind of resembled Busted, really, or any other boy band, more than the Sex Pistols. And so I think that's what fans were upset about.
And you came to this series then, to say the very least, with, would I say, would low expectations be an overstatement?
Yeah. I even slightly determined not to like it, maybe. You know, which is a terrible thing, really. But that's not what happened.
Oh, well, there you go. Now, this is, I suppose, is this, it's based on the Steve Jones memoir. So he kind of is the central character here, and certainly it's with him that we start our journey out in episode one. And his background, his childhood, and his fairly difficult upbringing, but his difficult teenage years are very much to the fore in the early part of the series.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. I mean, the actor, as I say, Toby Wallace, has to really carry not just the first episode, but a lot of it, because it is based around it's Steve Jones' story, and that's, you know, that leads to the problems with the court case that you mentioned and things like that. But his early life is tough. You know, when you say working class there, you know, very much working class, very poor background. His father left when he was two, I think. His mother was a hairdresser, but she married again. And as he revealed in the book called Lonely Boy, Tales from a Sex Pistol, he was abused by his stepfather. And his stepfather is kind of a recurring villain in this series.
And what we really get a sense of that he has this, the first episode is called Cloak of Invisibility. And, you know, you think of Harry Potter's Cloak of Invisibility and it's magical and it's this, that and the other. But this was a young boy who had this Cloak of Invisibility to literally pull around himself as a I don't know, 8, 9, 10 year old to kind of make himself invisible, and therefore he could do what he kind of wanted.
Yeah, and which included a lot of shoplifting.
And
there's a scene where the stepfather comes home and finds him with a new train set.
Yeah,
and
where did he get that?
This come from? Yeah. And he takes this shoplifting ethos, shall we say, into later life, and his nickname at the start of it is the Phantom of the Odeon, because he famously broke in. The first music we hear in this is David Bowie's Moonage Daydream.
Yeah,
and in 1973 he played the Ziggy Stardust gig in the Hammersmith Odeon, where he retired Ziggy Stardust, and there's a footage from that. And then, but the story is then that after that gig, Steve Jones breaks in to the Hammersmith Odeon, and it's all there on screen, so I'm not revealing anything. Steals the gear and goes round to his friends and says, he has the microphone from the Hammersmith Odeon, he says, look, you can see Bowie's lipstick is still on it.
But very, and this is a kind of a recurring theme, and all sorts of obviously phallic symbols and lipstick on the mic are played to their full potential. But the Moonage Daydream that we get played, It's interesting in that we see this acted out stealing of the gear, but we also see footage of, I don't know if it's the actual concert, but footage certainly of Ziggy Stardust, Bowie as Ziggy Stardust, and footage of the England of the time, which was not a good place to be living.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that was the time of industrial unrest, three-day week, and also mixed in with that at the same time. And maybe this is a kind of a cause for unrest. At the same time, you've been told to worship the Queen, because we're talking about everyone coming up to the Jubilee. So there was maybe you could say there was two Englands, you know, there was the upper class, and then there was very much a very poor country at the time.
Yeah. So and that kind of social realism, what we see on screen is a mix then of archive footage of the period. Certainly in episode one, does this continue right throughout the series?
It does,
that kind of archive footage beside acted out sequences from a script.
Yeah, and it uses strange things. I mean, Richard Branson turns up at one point, and they showed the Branston pickle ad as a joke on him from the '70s, and then you also have. You also have actual footage of the Pistols interspersed with the band in the series playing the shows. But it does bring in all that. It has stuff, and the Queen turns up a few times. The actual Queen turns up a few times just to hammer the point home.
Again, the footage. Archive footage. And we get in that early stage, we get the meeting up with McLaren and all of that type of things. But as the series progresses, do we get the band? How far in are we before we get the Sex Pistols lineup that we all know and love? When is that in place?
I think what you have from almost the very start is Jones's friendship with drummer Paul Cook, and Glenn Matlock is there. So they're in a band called, first of all, the Swankers, and then they changed that name to Cutie Jones and the Sex Pistols, and his Sex Pistols. They're not great. They're working towards it, but then it all starts to happen when John Lydon, Johnny Rotten, turns up, and that's episode two. Where he comes in, and it's the famous scene where this is all based around Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood's shop called Sex.
Sex, yeah.
And he was one of these people who were hanging around there, and they got him to audition by putting Alice Cooper's, is it 17? Yeah, I think it is, on the jukebox and getting him to sing along with him. That's a great scene in this, because you could say his voice is unique. Let's put it that way, And I think he's a great singer.
Yeah.
But he's not a conventional singer, and he certainly would have been a shock to people in 1976,
Yeah, but there's obviously a real clash of egos going on.
Oh, yeah, from the very start.
Let's play a clip that features Steve Jones, Toby Wallace playing Steve Jones. He's gone to see Johnny Rotten, Anson Boone playing Johnny Rotten, a missed rehearsal, and Johnny spells out his terms for joining the band.
My. It's Cutie Jones. What you want?
Better rehearsals. Sorry, it was a bit of a misunderstanding. We forgot.
Oh, yeah?
American's organising another and we'll be there.
I won't. The place was a shithole. The rats were so noisy we wouldn't have been able to hear each other.
I'll tell Malcolm.
I already have.
Good.
Not really.
What?
I don't think I can be in a band called Cutie Jones and his Sex Pistols. The name's disgusting. I might come to a rehearsal of a band called Sex Pistols. I told Malcolm that too.
Great.
And there you go. Bye. He's about to start his singing audition or whatever. So there we have Steve Jones played by Toby Wallace, and Johnny Rotten played by Anson Boone, in a clip from Pistol, which is the 6-part retelling of the Sex Pistols story. And Pat Carty has been watching it for us. What about the music in the series itself? How is that realised? Do the actors give us performed versions of the Sex Pistols music, or are we actually just hearing actual Sex Pistols performances? Is that how it works?
It a mix? When they make the records, when they play the records, presents the singles, you hear the actual tracks. And then when they're doing the live shows, it's the band. It's the TV band, if you like. I suspect there wasn't an awful lot of audio of the Pistols live that was of a quality that was usable, probably.
Right.
It's probably something to do with it. I thought maybe that was one thing that maybe took away from it slightly, but when I watched it again, actually, it didn't make a difference. And it's what they do is there's plenty of fluff notes, there's plenty of off-mic swearing, all that kind of thing. So it's more, could I say, audio verite than actual...
Fair enough. But, when you get to the Sex Pistols, and again, I'm going back, I suppose, to that picture and the kind of... The people saw it as a kind of a very acted version of the Pistols. The one thing that the Sex Pistols were not was acting, or certainly they had personas, they had an attitude, but they would run away from this idea that there was any kind of polished performance in what they were doing. Do we get that rawness? I've only seen one episode, and clunky enough in terms of how it mixed the archive footage and the acting itself. Do we get a sense of the anarchy that was in that group?
I think so, yeah. You get the early gigs, like ones in St. Martin's College, and it might be my favourite scene in it, where they're playing really as a band for in front of their own crowd for the first time. And there's also at the back of the room hippies, the older, and a fight starts, a fight breaks out from the band. But at the same time, they mix that in, just as you're talking about mixing the footage, of Rick Wakeman. From around the same time. Now, if people don't know, Rick Wakeman was the keyboard player with Yes, which would have been the enemy of the Sex Pistols, of course. But he made a record around that time based on the legends of King Arthur. And not only did he do that, and this was a hit record, not only did he do that, he played a couple of nights in Wembley Arena and he had actors act out the parts, but he did it on ice. Okay, so these actors going around on ice playing with plastic swords. And they have the footage of this. Now, if ever there was a reason for punk and the Sex Pistols come along, they show this here, and then in the middle of this fight, one of the characters picks up the television that's showing this and throws it out the window and it smashes on the ground, you know. So I just think it's a great scene, and it just really shows why perhaps punk was needed or why it happened in the first place.
Yeah, what about the Malcolm McLaren character? I mean, how instrumental is in this telling of the story, how instrumental is he in fact in getting the band together and getting the band moving in the first place?
In this version of it, he is instrumental. Now, that's the controversy that's always been around this story. Was it McLaren? Was it John Lydon? And, you know, I spoke to John Lydon.
I was going to say, you know what John Lydon thinks about this.
And he certainly had a few words to say about it. But
he's not happy.
He's not happy about it. But he you know, at the time when I interviewed him, that's a couple of weeks ago, he hadn't seen any of it. Nobody had.
Yeah.
So what he did, I mean, he took them to court. He famously took them to court, and what he was trying to do was veto the use of the Sex Pistols music. And when he was in court, it was pointed out to him by the judge that he'd already signed a band agreement years ago that said a majority was decision. And the judge even said to him, "Look, your lawyer should have told you this." And so he lost the case, so the music is in it. But I mean, that's always been the controversy around him. Lydon has said it was him, he did all these things. McLaren said it was him. There's a book by Grail Marcus that links McLaren with the Situationists from the 60s in Paris and all this thing. You maybe have to take that with a pinch of salt. But in this version of it, he is instrumental because he does bring them together. He pushes them to be more than just another pub rock band.
And you could even argue, certainly in the clip we're about to hear, where you'll hear Thomas Brodie Sangster plays Malcolm McLaren, and he calls into rehearsals here Anson Boone as Johnny Rotten, Toby Wallace as Steve Jones, and there's a difference of opinion between the two of them. And McLaren is kind of stoking the fire here. Let's have a listen to how it plays out. Strong language, by the way, I should warn in the midst of this.
That's what a good manager does. Gets a good deal, but the lease did cost me £1,000. And not to mention the fact that you have been living here rent-free.
How did you know?
I visited 2 days ago.
Did you?
Yeah. Here's some more black beauties.
I don't even get bus fare, and he gets amphetamines and free rent.
Shut the fuck up, John!
That's it.
Go on, go at him.
I'll go at you. Tear into each other like the seditionary sewer rats that you are.
What?
Oh, bloody hell.
For fuck's sake.
I want to hear the fury of the forgotten generation.
Play the riff.
What? What riff?
The only one you know, you bird. Go on.
A generation with no future. A generation with no other aim but to destroy. Yes, that's it, my boy. England's greatest guitarist. Just the two chords, is it? More like England's greatest moron.
There we go. Thomas Brodie Sangster as very posh Malcolm McLaren. Johnny Rotten played by Anson Boone. Steve Jones played by Toby Wallace in that scene from Pistol, the new six-part Disney Plus series directed by Danny Boyle. Does it work over? You said you came to it with low expectations. You came to it, in fact, wanting to not like it.
I kind of did, yeah.
And
I liked it. And I liked it. I think the thing is, we were on here not too long ago talking about rock biopics. And we said that the thing to remember is that a documentary is one thing and a dramatization is a different thing. And each of these episodes, a card comes up and says, the following is inspired by actual events. All right. So you got to take it that way, first of all. The music in it is great. The acting in it is great. The story tries to tell, does its best
How
to tell
How far does it bring us, by the way?
Well, it brings us all the way to, right. to the implosion. Sid passes away. They play the last gig in San Francisco, and that's
so
the
it's the whole story.
It's the whole story. And the music is fantastic. As I say, it tries to tell every side of the story. McLaren, that you mentioned there, he does become very much the villain. Mm. Towards the end of the piece. I mean, after Sid passes away, there's a scene where he's going, oh, how am I going to sell these t-shirts now? And then he says, oh, he's dead. And he puts that on the t-shirt, something like that anyway. And you're just, you're boo hissing at the screen, you know, right. that kind of thing. Yeah. But there is a great ending to it, which is probably made up, where Rotten and Jones sit down together and said, look, we did some things. And it refers back to a very special moment, which was Huddersfield on Christmas Day in 1977. And a very little known story that they played this benefit for the kids of striking firemen. And, you know, and it's a great scene where they're handing out presents and all this. So,
and you don't think of the Sex Pistols in those terms, really, do you? You know,
no, but the thing is, I mean,
doing a charity gig.
They could be looked back on as maybe a kind of a joke thing, maybe at this remove, but that's not the case. The music is vital. And now people are going to look at this and go, and they'll be like me with that picture. They go, I don't care. I don't like it. It's not punk enough, but I don't think so.
All right. You don't think so. So you're saying go ahead and watch. That's Pat Carty speaking to us about Pistol, which will be released on Disney Plus on May the 31st, and we should leave the last word to the boys themselves back in the day. Freddie Bacon from the Sex Pistols and the Disney Plus series, which is simply called Pistol, as I said, starting on May 31st on Disney Plus. Now, the red carpet may not be as meme-tastic as last year, but Cannes 2022 is back to its glamorous and arty self, whetting global cinema's appetite for new work from the likes of Baz Luhrmann, David Cronenberg and Claire Denis. With Crimes of the Future, Cronenberg envisages a world where medical advances mean experiences of bodily pain and pleasure are at a premium. Two artists willing to cater for the somewhat niche sexual tastes are played by Cronenberg regular Viggo Mortensen and Léa Seydoux. Baz Luhrmann unveiled his Elvis biopic, complete with actual Presley family members on the red carpet. Perhaps not the critical reception he might have wanted, however. But as always in Cannes, it's not just about the films. I'm joined now from the Croisette by Tara Brady, who has been in Cannes all week. I suppose, Tara, I know this is a relatively post-COVID Cannes. We're nearly back to normal. Last year, very tedious, tricky for attendees. Is it much easier going this time around?
It is much easier, and they're reporting that the numbers are up on last year, but it's certainly not back to regular levels. It's very interesting as well, because there's been a lot of muttering, I think, you know, particularly among the press, but also among distributors and producers, that it's not quite as appetizing as last year. Two things, really, but mostly it's because we're spoiled. Last year we were so spoiled because there were so many films that were hanging over and that were waiting for release, so they ended up with a glut of really, really big name titles. It was also kind of a perfect storm last year. If you remember, I was talking to you last year in July from Cannes, so it coincided with Bastille Day, and there was a real party atmosphere everywhere all the way through. But there was also those kind of films that you get that you can't really engineer. I mean, this year there's a lot of really big name guys back, like Hirokazu Koreeda, David Cronenberg, Park Chan-wook. All these guys are back in the program, and you're looking and you're going, wow. But it doesn't have those kind of really talked about films that were there last year, like Red Rocket or Annette or Worst Person in the World. Yeah. They were all films that everyone was really buzzing about, and of course Titan, which went on to win last year.
And I'm glad you said July, because I was thinking, is it really a year year since we were speaking about this, but no, it's not actually a full year just yet. Although it is 10 months or 9 or 10 months. Anyway, let's get to the films and some of the standouts for you. Close is a particular, I think, possibly one of the best films you've seen so far at the festival. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Well, Close, I think, is when I went to bed last night and I thought, well, Close is definitely going to win the Palme d'Or. But I got up this morning and, well, you can always trust the French to have a different opinion. They hate it. Le Monde gave it one star.
Wow.
So, but it's a really, I mean, it has something of a playground if you saw it recently. It's like a proper kind of child eyes view film, but it's 2 13-year-olds, Leo and Remy. They're really, really good friends. They're growing up in Belgium. It's completely idyllic. It's sunny. They're very close. They're always playing these kind of mad, imaginative games. And they start middle school, and one of the girls, and not even in a mean way, turns around and says, "Are you a couple?" And suddenly Leo starts to push his lifelong best chum away, and it's all these kind of very small things. It's a very, very delicately constructed drama, and it really is absolutely heartbreaking. But it's just so brilliantly constructed. It's one of those films you can probably an hour in go, well, I know exactly where this is going to go, and it doesn't really matter that you know where it's going to go. It's incredibly powerful all the way through. So it's a really remarkable film. But as I said, the French hate it.
Yeah, so Le Monde can think what they want. For you, it's a 5-star movie. Lucas Dant, the director here, and you're certainly, it's in your book for a possible Palme d'Or.
Yes, I think so.
David Cronenberg, Crimes of the Future. First reviews compare it to his controversial 90s film Crash, about the subculture of people who are sexually aroused by car crashes. We're not 1,000 miles off car crashes here. Very different type of... how different is the type of sexual arousal subculture that he's talking about here?
Well, it's certainly not for the faint of heart. There are implements involved, and I think the film probably reminds me most of is Videodrome, and there's definitely if you watched another filmmaker make it, you go, oh, this guy's referencing David Cronenberg. But of course, it does feel there's a moment, I think, where Lisa Zadu unzips Viggo Mortensen's belly and starts poking her tongue around inside, and that's a very, very kind of direct.
Yeah.
Well, he couldn't say it's a steal from Videodrome, because it's Cronenberg made Videodrome.
Yeah.
But there, it has this incredibly mad world, where their art requires the surgical removal of additional organs that his body keeps growing, and she tattoos these and takes out, and voila, then there's this kind of weird new world around it. There are these strange skeletal chairs that are supposed to make eating and sleeping easier, and they look like indigestion and never sleep again to me. And then there's this kind of radical plastic kind of advocates underground, who the film, even within its own logic, kind of owns up to the fact that there's a conversation that the plastic group have, and they go, well, I'm not sure how this plastic sort of fetish that we've developed has somehow genetically passed on, but it has. It's a miracle. And you kind of have to go with it.
That's Cronenberg. It has a real whiff of Cronenberg off it, for sure. Let's have a listen to a clip. Kristen Stewart is a character called Timlin here, and she's approaching Viggo Mortensen's Saul. She has just seen perform some kind of operation or some kind of act with his partner, Caprice, a former trauma surgeon, and she's very interested in what she just saw, is Kristen Stewart's character, Timlin.
Do you mind if I ask you something intimate?
Hi. No, go ahead.
Surgery is sex, isn't it?
Is it?
You know it is. Surgery is the new sex.
Does it have to be new sex?
Yes. It's time. When I was watching Caprice cut into you, I wanted.
Yeah.
I wanted you to be cutting into me. That's what I knew. What was that all about?
Just another epiphany. art triumphs once again.
Viggo Mortensen and Kristen Stewart there in a scene from David Cronenberg's Crimes of the Future. I think Surgery is the New Sex has to be the tagline for that film. Although I am particularly fond of Does There Have to Be New Sex from the Viggo Mortensen character there as well. Elvis, Baz Luhrmann back, much anticipated biopic Elvis. Red carpet for the premiere was an event in and of itself. The Legend's family have been to Cannes getting behind the release. What did you make of the film?
Well, it's very much a game of two halves. I have to admit, I really loved Romeo and Juliet, and I really loved Strictly Ballroom from all those years ago, but I have not been a big fan, or I was not a big fan of Australia, for example, and I was not a big fan of Moulin Rouge. It was a film I wanted to throttle and tell to shut up for most of the runtime. But this one has kind of, the first half is very kind of top-loaded with kind of the worst sort of Baz Luhrmann excesses, where it's just all these kind of fast cuts and he's cramming everything in. And if you want to see a movie about, like, for example, Fun Records and Elvis, well, blink and you miss it. Well, if you, you know, blink twice, you certainly miss Tom Phillips, like, the entire appearance. And so it's just this kind of blur of things. But I think in the second half, once we get to Vegas, like, Vegas is much more kind of a Baz Luhrmann town. It's more kind of more musical numbers.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of settles into a groove. I'm not sure this idea of, like, Colonel Tom Parker as the devil, as played by Tom Hanks, entirely works. And I think when the film tries to be Baz Luhrmann's America and say kind of bigger, you know, bigger things about race in America and things, it doesn't quite come off at all. But, you know, as the kind of a big joyful karaoke session at the end, I mean, it really worked very well.
Also, Elvis's granddaughter, Riley Keough, was there in Cannes with her directorial debut, in fact, as is her grandmother, Priscilla, is there as well. So
yes.
did you see that film, or has that happened yet?
So War Pony was on, and I can actually, is a new film from Riley Keough, and it's about the Native American population, and it in fact did win a prize today because it won the Palm Dog, which is the film they give in Cannes every year for the last 20 years to the best dog, and so that one that was the overall winner of the Palm Dog, and the runner up was a really nice Icelandic sort of sheepdog collie thing. I'm not too sure what the breed is. It looked like a little kind of scrubbing brush with legs and a very waggy tail. And it was from a fantastic Icelandic film called, our Danish film called Godland.
Oh, yes. And I'm very happy for any veterinary surgeon who can tell us what the squiggly scrubbing brush with a tail, what particular breed of dog that is. If they could clarify, I'd be more than happy to hear on 51551. Claire Denis, of course, French Hauteur, premiered Stars at Noon. Joe Alwyn, we were watching on our screens at the moment as Nick in Conversations with Friends, starring this, as is Margaret Qualley. What sort of film are we getting from Denis this time round?
Not a very good one. I mean, as you know, even her best work tends to be quite random, and this one is random in a really kind of... But it also takes a novel that's sort of set during the Nicaraguan Revolution, and then when it updates it to the modern day, it doesn't really know what to do with this kind of spy drama, so you end up with a sort of, you know, sex film that doesn't really convince you.
Right.
You've got two very pretty people rubbing up against each other in Joe Alwyn and Margaret Qualley, but you wouldn't say they're coming down with sexual chemistry, and a lot of that's down to the fact that the script is really odd.
Okay.
I think she's meant to be some kind of femme fatale, but and she just comes off as being inconsistent rather than untrustworthy. So it didn't really do anything for me at all. It's a very odd film, very disappointing, I'm afraid.
Can't let you go without talking about the red carpet. Obviously, Timothy and Tilda from last year memed all over the place. Sharon Stone impressed this year, but otherwise, she's much beloved at Cannes. Anything else that of note that you saw or that's getting the gossip columns?
Well, I think that the Elvis red carpet was the big one. I remember thinking, you know, during watching the Oscars, going, these all look like cocktail dresses, and it feels like all the ball gowns have been saved up for Cannes and dusted down. But yeah, Sharon Stone has really made this festival her own. You know, and 64, she's looking really good. She's letting the grey thing, but she still has that kind of spiky haircut that she had in the 90s. But just like little playful details, like turning up in aviator glasses on the red carpet, and she turned up in another Dolce. If we remember last year, we were talking about the big floral gown, and it was another Dolce & Gabbana design this year that turned out to be. Oh, she revealed she pulled, you know, one section of it off, and it was two dresses. And for the occasion, she had two gentlemen escorts down the red carpet.
Quite right. Why wouldn't she? Why wouldn't she? Finally, then, a couple of contenders maybe for the Palme d'Or. And if you would you give me your prediction on it?
Oh, well, it's always impossible to say the Palme d'Or. If you remember last year, nobody had Titan in the running. And like all the kind of big critics. Though I think on the ground, there was a feeling there was a real buzz about Titan among us kind of smaller ranking critics. I would say close, but the Park Chan-wook's new film is also in the running. There's also like they could also go for the Corrida. They could go for one of the kind of big established names. But yeah, I still think it'll go to close in the official competition, and maybe Godland, which is a really great film about a priest losing his faith, and with kind of overtones of Heart of Darkness. I think that might take in certain regard. That All would right. be my bet. But hey, it's Cannes. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm not going to hold you to it, Tara. It's okay. I won't be quoting it back to you in a few days' time. Listen, enjoy the rest of it, if that's possible, because it all sounds very glamorous. I'm sure there's a lot of work involved too. So thanks for being with us this evening. That's Tara Brady speaking to us from Cannes 2022. Time now for album reviews, where our two Sonic aficionados share their views on the new releases. With me now, Brian Boyd and Zara Hederman tonight. Former Oasis all-round bad boy Liam Gallagher brings us Come On, You Know. Dundalk five-piece Just Mustard released their second album, Heart Under. And Wilco, with lead man Jeff Tweedy, goes a bit more country on an album called Cruel Country. Let's start with William. If it's what does his mother call him that? William Gallagher, come over here to us and sing us a song. Why don't you start, Liam, with Everything Electric?
I don't hate you, but I despise that feeling. There's nothing left for me here. You won't know if you don't go. Superficial feelings. Is that to take it easy underneath the red sun? Everything's electric.
No, that's a new song. A very new song from Liam Gallagher, not an old Oasis song, as you might have thought. That is Everything Electric from Liam Gallagher's new album, Come On, You Know. Zara, after falling out with his brother and making up with his brother and falling out with his brother a million and one times. Anyway, Oasis 2009, I suppose, is the kind of watershed moment. He went off in his solo career, as you were. 2017 was the solo album. How has his solo career been developing, Liam? I'm sure actually he wouldn't have been called William by anybody. He'd have been annoyed if he was called William.
Yeah, I would think very little it takes to annoy him. Mm. Yeah, his solo career started in 2017 with As You Were, and he has developed from that point a really strong team around him. So he's got a guy called Andrew Wyatt and Greg Kirsten, who are working with him as like producers and songwriters. And Andrew Wyatt, actually, in particular, he won an Oscar recently for his work on the song Shallow from A Star Is Born. Greg Kirsten actually won a Grammy for his work on Liam's first album for his production work. So his work has actually been critically lauded. Now, obviously, the British press is going to give Liam a bit of a leg up, because he is one of the last great rock stars of his generation. He is endlessly entertaining. He is quite an endearing front person. And I mean, as you said, this sounds a bit like Oasis. Liam is the voice of Oasis. Yeah. Without him, there isn't really Oasis.
But are we getting anything new? I mean, as I said, Brian, when that track started, we were all in studio. I said, well, there you go. There's a new song from Oasis. Are we getting anything new from Liam Gallagher on this third album? You know, from As You Were and Why Not, the second album?
No, nothing new at all. It's status quo.
And is that a problem?
It is a problem, because it's just status quo B-sides. I mean, the PR for this album is, I mean, these songs would not have been released if Liam Gallagher's name wasn't associated with them. The PR for the Everything's Electric, which we just heard, said it sounds like the Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter meeting the Beastie Boys. It doesn't. It's a song David Grohl, who co-wrote it, found down the back of his couch. It's it's this album, it's all fur coat and no knickers. It sounds like a tins of lager in a plastic bag. If that could make an album, that would be the album we're hearing now. The songs are derivative. It's bloke rock of the worst order. It's all aggressive, what are you looking at type vocals. The production is fantastic. It sounds wonderful. But there simply aren't any songs there. When you strip it away, there aren't any songs there. And it's just been sold in the fact that it's Liam Gallagher and we got good production and we got in songwriters. But it's simply, the songs don't stand up.
Yeah, and a nice little choir to start it off, all off, as we hear on this track.
Talking like they're gods, but that's just not the deal. If you want to keep the things you love, then you better learn to kneel. Father, Father, see so many things now that you're gone. How I wish I had more power. Oh yeah, how I wish I had more power.
Now, all I can think of when I hear that is, you know, was Liam Gallagher asked by some school, will you write us a wee song for our school assembly and will you come in and sing a bit of it halfway through it? Because it opens like kind of John Rutter meets Liam Gallagher, John Rutter being the big, you know, kind of composer of carols.
Well, I think it's Liam Gallagher trying to be Mick Jagger with a rendition of You Can't Always Get What You Want. And that is kind of nodded at as well in some of the lyrical kind of meters. You know, he sings in that you won't get the girl you want, but you'll get the girl you need. And obviously, you know, he's always talked about how he loves the Beatles and he loves the Rolling Stones. And as Brian was saying, there's nothing new here. It is derivative, but like, it's funny, like,
but he's a derivative of himself,
a derivative of Mick Jagger and the Beatles and like other
so
bits.
That's the same as Oasis, really,
and then derivative of his Twitter threads as well. So
Right, stars from you first of all, Zara, on this one.
I don't think I'll be returning to this, so it's a 2.5 from me.
There's a very polite dismissal. I don't think I'll be returning to this. Brian?
1.5. I'm talking about lyrics. The higher we can go, the longer we can fly. Oh, for God's sake, Liam.
The higher we can go, the longer we can fly. So you didn't like, and it's 1.5. 2.5, 1.5, is that what we had there? Right, let's move on to Just Mustard. This is 4 years since their debut album, Wednesday. Just Mustard have been busy putting out singles like Frank, October and Seven, touring with Fontaine's DC. And this is their second album that they're giving us to us this evening, Heart Under. Just tell us a little bit about this Dundalk Five piece before we hear from them, Brian.
As you said, they're from Dundalk. They first appeared on the radar with their debut album, Wednesday, which was released in 2018. That was sort of a shoegazy affair, and the pandemic and the resultant confinement to studio quarters has seen them really reupholster the sound. What really impressed me is this is an Irish rock band who have been listening to the great German industrial rock band Einstürzende Neubauten. I'm not sure I pronounced them correctly. And there are shades of My Bloody Valentine, the great Irish noise band from the 1990s, in that they have the female lead singer, Katie Ball. They use her vocal as an extra instrument. Everything's layered on. It's a very different album from where they began.
Yeah.
It's very dark. It's very post-goth, very scary.
Right. Let's have a listen to a track called I Am You. You from Just Mustard Dundalk Band, and this from their second album, isn't it? Yes, Heart Under. It is dark stuff, and there's a kind of repetitive quality to that. Repetitive is either, you know, kind of gets in and you like a litany, or it sends you to sleep. Which is it in your case, Sarah?
It sends me into a bit of a frustrated state, I would have to say, because I do love repetition in songs when it's done well and when, you know, what is being repeated kind of resonates or it feels worthwhile. But I just feel that, and I would also posit as well, on top of what Brian was saying with their influences, is that Gillaband and Warpaint for sure have been listened to and studied very closely for this album. And I think when you take away some of the distorted, the pedal boards and the snarling guitar and bass, there's actually not really a lot of substance, I think, to the songwriting in this album, which, as we were saying with the repetition, I think is a real kind of downfall to this album. And I just wish that in those 4 years that they had used them with a bit more kind of creativity and pushing themselves. They also self-produced this album. They signed to Partisan label, which Fontaines are on, and I really wish that they had maybe worked with an external producer to challenge them.
Yeah, the exit of the pair of ears from outside is never a bad thing. It has to be said, because you can always just disagree with it and do what you're going to do yourself anyway. What about a track like Seeds, though, Brian? That, I think, gives a real sense of that, the mix of the guitar and the searing vocals. Is that where it's at its best?
Yes, and they have this dual electric guitar, a sonic assault, and it's a real sort of industrial rock guitar sound, and then you get these skyscraping vocals, and the percussion is all broody, and it's all it all coalesces to produce moments of almost shimmering musical beauty. But not everything works, and they do find themselves going up more than one creative cul-de-sac. But in terms of reaching artistically for something different,
they're trying.
They're absolutely trying, and they are succeeding on certain songs. I mean, you have to admire their integrity and their reach.
And Seed, I think you thought this was probably one of the best on the album, or am I putting words in your mouth, Sarah?
To me, actually, just even the name of the song, I can't really distinguish it, because a lot of them to me just sounded quite similar to each other, which
let's have a listen,
didn't work.
Listen to a little bit of Seed. Just a little flavour there of Seed from Just Mustard. I didn't have a lot of time with that album today, and I must say I do want to have more of a listen. Maybe it will demand that. Will you go back to it, Sarah, or are you kind of, is it too much like hard work in that respect, and Stars?
I would love to go back to it, and I would love for them to do something a bit more different and challenging to themselves for their third album. Like, I will always kind of listen to a Just Mustard album. So for me, it was a 2 out of 5.
What are you saying, Brian?
I thought it was very big and very brave of them. It was almost as if an Irish Phil Spector producing a Depeche Mode. 3.5.
3.5 from you, Brian. That's pretty a solid score from Brian on that one. Let's move on to Wilco then, Chicago-based alternative rock band Jeff Tweedy as their vocalist. Cruel Country is their new album. Deep dive into America. Stupid and cruel, red, white and blue, as Tweedy puts it. Let's hear how cruel a country Wilco thinks the US is.
Stupid and cruel, red, white and blue. All you have to do is sing in the choir, kill yourself every once in a while.
It's great to have an Irish song with a couple of coconuts in the middle of it, isn't it? Cruel Country there from Wilco. Certainly musically, it's not that cruel a sound. Lyrically, is he scathing in this? Are Wilco scathing here, Brian?
There's really great lyrics on this. What it is really, it's a concept album about the USA and about the history of the USA. So just what we heard there, they're talking about the red, white and blue and his very much his love-hate thing. with the USA. But also, you get down to some of the songs. And they're talking about how we tend to forget that the US of A was colonized and the indigenous population were murdered. And he sings, there's no middle ground when the other side would rather kill than compromise. And then he goes on to, he starts singing about these dangerous streams have been detected streaming over the southern border. So he's putting the history of the US into context of what is going on now about in the culture wars with the rows about immigration and the rows about naturalized citizens. So it is this almost alternative history of the US, even though, as we heard, the music is very sweet and very pedestrian. The lyrics are really come with a kick. And you have to listen carefully to hear them.
I was thinking that demands then that you have to stop what you're at and listen properly, but you have to stop, is it for 21 tracks and listen to 21 country songs? Do you feel a bit preached at?
No, not at all. Because I think, as you were saying there, Jeff Tweedy has always been an incredible lyricist. And I think on this album, maybe it's the country kind of influence, but I really feel that he's like tapped into a bit of a Bob Dylan kind of surrealist character too with some of his words. And I always found that, you know, throughout the 77 minutes of this album, it flew by for me, because this kind of brought about as well certain flourishes of Wilco's brilliant experimentation and meandering. And this is the first album, Jeff Tweedy was saying, since 30,007 Sky Blue Sky, where they all recorded live together and he's allowed, like, all the band, they're all virtuosos in their own field, and you can really tell that, and it keeps you engaged.
Let's have a listen to a bit of a track called When I Am My Mother.
Dangerous dreams have been detected streaming over the southern border. As bad as it seems, it's worse than expected. Fleeing through the night corridor. Oh, I've done the math with a stick.
So that's a little flavour of Why I Am My Mother from Wilco and the new album Cruel Country. I was saying, as we're listening to that, Brian Boyd, this is country music with a lot of irony.
And this is the funny thing, Sean, because they've always been, I mean, they were sort of alt-American, alt-Americana band, but they've spent their 30-year career going, oh, no, we're actually a rock band, we're not a country music band. But now they're sort of saying, yes, we have embraced our inner twang. And here's slide guitars and here's pedal steel.
But they're using them for...
And they're using it for a very good reason, because, as we were just saying, like, white country music in America carries baggage, political baggage. And he has turned it back on itself and says, you think you know your history, you don't. This is the real history.
Yeah, I was kind of feeling it's like a Sam Shepard play. Yeah. It would sound, sound right in a Sam Shepard play. Starts from you, Brian, before you get a final judgment.
4.5, loved it. It's 21 songs, but as Zara was saying, you
don't mind.
You fall into line with them.
Zara?
Yeah, 4.5. For me as well. I think this is one of their best works of recent years, and it's well worth your time.
Well worth your time. 77 minutes, 21 songs, but both Zara Hederman and Brian Boyd giving it 4.5 stars. That's Cruel Country from Wilco. Our other two albums this evening, Heart Under from Just Mustard, and Come On You Know from Liam Gallagher.